Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I've been enjoying the time on my walking path the past few weeks. The weather's been so nice and conducive to being out there, and even during the day it's not been so hot, and there's enough shade on my path that just makes it really nice to be out there for parts of the afternoons. Mosquitoes are just starting to appear, so it's been pretty quiet, but still not too bad. So by myself, spending a lot of time out there. And I don't know if it's just this year or if it's been like this out there on that walking path. I've got a fairly new walking path last November, myself and Samanera Kantiko, Samanera Gambiro, put together a new walking path with some planks on it that make it easier to walk on and easier to keep care of, so I spend more time now. And I've just started noticing that this year in particular, there's a huge number of lizards that are starting to occupy that area as well. It might be the deck itself, because it's very close to the ground, just on a couple of supported by 2x6s, and so there's a couple inches of space beneath the planks and the ground, and it might be a perfect habitat for lizards to hang out, hide underneath, and then scoot up onto the deck when they want some warmth of sun. So there's a whole contingent along the length of the Jhongrum path, and I've been noticing that they have kind of their little territories. There's a few kind of on kind of dominate one end, about half of the walking path, and then a separate group that kind of hang out at the far end, and they spend a lot of the time that I'm on the path darting in front of me and back and forth and just kind of whooping it up a bit. There's one in particular that was a slightly different shade, so it's quite distinctive, and I'm just going to refer to it as he, because I don't really know, but I don't know lizard anatomy all that well, but he, because he also has kind of territorial aggressive behavior, so I'll assign that gender to him. he seems to be kind of a little more protective of what he is considering his space than maybe some of the others, and has tended not to get much out of the way when I'm walking along. And I don't want to deprive him of his right to that space just as much as I do, so I don't consider it completely my Jhongrum path. But, you know, I figure he and they have got it for a good, 21, 22 hours of the day, so I'm due a little bit. and kind of relentlessly almost tripping on this particular one, because he kind of just stands there and looks quite defiant, protecting his territory. You know, I don't know if you've ever watched lizards, but they do these little push-ups. So he kind of gets out there and stands in front of me and looks at me and does his little push-ups and doesn't move until I get just inches away. So I'm always kind of worried that I'm going to step on it or kick it or whatever. And finally I decided a few weeks ago that I needed to assert my right to have a little bit of freedom with my walking meditation, lizard freedom from lizard presence there, having to step over it, around it. And decided to try and shoo it off and see if I could train it to maybe just stay out of my way for the time I'm on the path. And I fully admit that I might be projecting a lot of emotional status onto these lizards. But anyway, so I got out my broom and just kind of gently give it a little bit of a hint that, you know, move on, get off the path. And would most of the time I wouldn't get it too far near it. They'd just run away. And particularly this one would run away and just out of reach of the broom. So it was more of a kind of an empty threat. But every now and then I'd give it a little nudge and contact, and it would jump off the path, and immediately after I passed would jump back on. And so this went on for a little while. And I kind of inadvertently one time caught it just at the right time, and it wasn't moving, and I was, I don't know, maybe I was expecting it would, or it just wasn't maybe as careful or mindful as I should, and I really made contact with the poor thing and sent him kind of sailing through the air to a few feet on the lower level of my jungum path, and it kind of hit with a bounce, you know, and I didn't intend it to be quite as strong as it ended up being, and he landed on his tail, and the back half of the tail snapped off. My heart broke, you know. But I also kept in the back of my mind, well, you know, this might be also a defense mechanism. Some critters that have long tails, I think, can easily lose their tail when a prey is chasing them or grabbing them as a defense mechanism. And so I thought, well, maybe this is the case, and maybe he isn't irreparably harmed. And he was a few feet away from his disembodied tail, and or a little piece of the tail anyway. And it was still seemed to be alive, so I was kind of watching closely for a while, and he kind of scattered off. But then I didn't see him for a few days, and I started to get concerned that maybe I'd done him in unintentionally, and was feeling remorseful, and of course apologized to him if he could hear me many times. but didn't see him for a while, and then about a week later, he reappeared. I was so relieved, and, you know, I could easily tell who he was. And I nicknamed him Stubby. So that's a relationship with Stubby now. But and he was pretty grungy for a while, meaning kind of like he stayed his distance. And I thought, well, this is interesting. You know, maybe he learned from my unfortunate experience to kind of stay off. But in the past few days, those circuits that were set in place with the trauma of losing half of his tail, maybe they wore out, and now he's back onto my path and doing the same thing and kind of just staying just out of reach, and my almost tripping on him and doing his push-ups and looking at me out of the corner of his eye. So we're back to the same old kind of response. And you know, I just assume that it's some sort of territorial kind of thing, that he's vying with me for that space. I haven't had the heart to get the broom out again. I learned my lesson that way, but I actually tried yesterday to kind of stop and while he was at the in one of the sunlight patches, and I just stopped and, you know, about a foot away from him, just tried to engage in a little bit of heart-to-heart discussion, but he wasn't having anything to do with it. So anyway, this is kind of a long-winded digression, but it kind of made me think, too, of, you know, this reptilian brain that is motivated by some very basic impulses, like want, food, or reproduction, or fear, or aggression. Maybe it looks like there's maybe a little bit of dosa going on there, and you know, a lot of delusion. But just how, you know, this territorial type behavior, this kind of what, you know, sometimes is called the reptilian brain, is very clear in operation. And just seeing that actually those impulses are in us as human beings too. You know, luckily we have a bit more going for us than just only those basic impulses. You know, we're very lucky to have the abilities to look at our own reptilian impulses that come up in our minds every now and then, or maybe more than every now and then, but be able to have a bit more perspective and handle on how to deal with them. And it kind of reminds me, too, of that analogy that often Ajahn Lungpa Pasano often likes to use. He does this incredibly wonderful imitation of the Buddha's story of the dung beetle, who's this beetle that basically lives on the top of a pile of dung. That's his home, his food source. And the dung beetle is incredibly proud of his domain. He sits on top of his pile of dung and you know, proudly proclaims that, you know, this is my dung, my pile of dung. And how we, you know, similar to that kind of reptilian brain, is that we, you know, actually can feel a lot of possession around our where our basic moods and impulses and desires and very coarse habits of mind. Sometimes, you know, it's sort of like, well, whatever they are, they're mine, you know, and how we can be so deluded into having a sense of ownership and possession and the right to this pile of dung that we tend to find ourselves operating from. All the various forms of greed, hatred, delusion. So it's, you know, part of our practice is just really recognizing that, you know, we bring with us a huge amount of conditioning towards desire seeking, towards aversion, towards all of these underlying tendencies. Delusion, confusion, that keep us bound in samsara because we haven't quite figured out completely how to transcend them, to move beyond them. But unlike the lizard, the dung beetle, we have the ability to do that. It's part of our inheritance, being a human being, having developed enough good karma, enough merit to be born in a human body and have a human brain that also has a you know, a neocortex that can deal with and process our desires to reflect. That's a unique human ability, the ability to reflect on our experience and see how it is that we bring suffering into our lives and maybe to understand how we can move away from that. One of the suttas that we recite, chant every now and then, is the Fire Sermon, which talks about all the six sense bases and various aspects of mental processes that we experience through the six sense bases, the organ itself, the object of the organ, you know, like the eye and forms, and consciousness as it arises in that sense base, contact, the feeling tone that's in relation to all of that, these various aspects of each of the six sense bases, and that they're essentially on fire with the with the passion, aversion, delusion, on fire with birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair. A very graphic image of the experience of our sense bases and how they overtake our experience when they're experienced with the underlying tendencies of passion, hatred, delusion. Particularly, you know, we all experience it through all the sense bases and maybe at times most acutely through the mind itself, or mano, maybe a little better translated as intellect, mind organ, as distinct from citta, which is also translated as mind. But this basic process of the mind organ and its dhammas, its mind objects. Ajahn Jeff translates it as intellect and ideas, as the objects of the intellect. And the diversity of experience through the intellect, the intellect being sort of the active portion of mind experience, where ideas manifest, where we analyze data, where we categorize things, where we organize information, form relationships in our mind, conceptions, different productions of the mental process. Thinking, of course, is being the primary one. Ideas, process of intellect, ideas, and how these are burning. That the intellect itself has the capacity to be overtaken by and influenced with the burning of passion, aversion, confusion, delusion, and that motivates how the mind, the intellect, operates. The objects it seeks out as an expression of the underlying tendencies, the objects it picks up of all the thoughts and ideas and conceptions that we create that are burning, burning with our desires, so that we seek out the mind, the intellect seeks out objects to gratify the burning of the desire that's at the root of much of our daily experience, seeking out objects of pleasure and delight, and ways of temporarily allaying that burning fever of desire, because that kind of desire, when you really consider it and really reflect on it, is not a pleasant state. It's a state of wanting. It's a state of not feeling replete, not feeling complete. And its basic urge or its basic motivation is actually to see its own demise. Desire does not want to be. There's the seeking through objects, of course, of the five physical senses, but also the objects of the mind for gratification in many different ways, the thoughts we think, the fantasies we engage in, as a way of alleviating that underlying desire. So we burn with that process. Same with aversion, the underlying tendency. Something comes along and ignites a sense of irritation or, dislike, aversion. And the objects that we seek, thoughts of getting back, or thoughts of, setting somebody straight, or just general nattering and complaining about a situation in our minds, how easy it is to get involved with that and engage with that and move into that. the consciousness, mana vijnanam, that is related to that, the underlying ability for us to pick up on this urge that's bubbling at a very subconscious level, and tune our attention using the mental factor of attention to advert the consciousness to a particular sense sphere to fulfill that burning of passion or hatred or confusion, directing our conscious experience to one of these six sense-based spheres, in this case the sphere of the mind, so that, you know, particularly if it's really intense, how much we can really be consciously involved in the mental realm and not even be aware of what's going on around us in the world of sights and sounds and tastes. The mental drive, the mental capacity is so entangled with this conscious attention that becomes a very strong and significant part of our experience, where we dwell a lot of the time. And then the three of those come together, the mind, or the intellect, the objects, the ideas, the consciousness, and blooms into a full-blown experience of contact, and the feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral that comes with contact, the experience on a very involved level, and how those experiences of feeling, the pleasant ones, even further ignite the underlying tendency towards desire, and the feelings of the unpleasant feelings that can arise further support and ignite the underlying tendency towards aversion and the underlying tendency of delusion to sort of just keep us involved in a state of confusion, seeking. Those are the objects of neutral experience, supported by the delusion mind. And how all of this process just keeps feeding on itself, burning over and over again. And we're caught in this web of stimulus and response based on this not understanding, not being able to see clearly this process going on all the time in the mind. On a very simple level, that's what's happening in that reptilian experience. But there is, the potential for moving beyond that. We have, again, like I was saying, we have this human ability to reflect and to look at this habitual experience. And we are all here because we have some notion that there is some way we can transcend that kind of stimulus response, automatic experience, through looking and considering and quieting the mind to the point where we can see this process happen more clearly, and being able to penetrate and understand it and experience it, and developing the stamina and the bravery, in a sense, to start to face these patterns. And it takes that kind of willingness to see it clearly and to bear up with some of the difficulties by looking at it directly. You know, I think it was Ajahn Chah who said that 90% of our practice is making the same mistakes over and over again until you just get tired of doing it. And it takes that kind of attitude, that perseverance, to keep being willing continue to make mistakes, but look at them as clearly as one can, and to be able to face that first noble truth of, well, this is dukkha, and this is how it arises. So one of the things that comes to mind also is how to do that and what it can result in if one does. And I was just been rereading The Island, Lungpo Pasano and Ajahn Amaro's book on the teachings about Nibbana, kind of a compilation of the Buddha's words on the goal of practice. And one of the passages that I was just reading was quoting Ajahn Chah and his last communication before he got really ill and was unable to communicate very clearly at all for the last 10 years of his life. Just before that happened, he wrote he rarely wrote things, but had somebody write a brief letter to Ajahn Sumedho, who had moved to the West by that time. And it was a fairly short statement, but it started with, let's see if I can remember, something like, wherever there is love or hate for anything in the world, these can be your aids and partners in developing parami, or paramita, the perfections. So taking that concept of you know, all these unpleasant, difficult underlying tendencies that lead us into wanting or not wanting, love or hate, with the various aspects of experience, the various aspects of our world, using that and developing them and exploring them and understanding them in a way that is developing the paramitas, the strong qualities, transforming them in a way into something that's painful or difficult and habitually taking us in the wrong direction, and using our experience with them to develop good qualities that will aid us on the path, so that, you know, we have feelings of desire, wanting, that seem out of control, but the more we get a handle on them, experience them, particularly through the lens of Dhamma, through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, of realizing the suffering and difficulty involved with continuing to follow, that we can develop some of the perfections, the paramitas, the qualities that help us cross over, like patience, a bit of restraint. These are some of the qualities that we can develop in the face of overwhelming want or need or craving. Similarly, equanimity, a balance, being able to see things more clearly, that we don't jump into reaction. The same with aversion, the irritations, that difficulties that come up in the mind, the wanting to get away from, and similarly being able to develop kindness and virtue, and counteract these tendencies with qualities like generosity and all the other perfections, and particularly the quality of wisdom, panya, being able to see through the lens of wisdom that these are all tendencies, habitual tendencies of the mind, but that they can be transcended and seen as impermanent, suffering, not self. So using what our experience is to help transform the mind into a bank of really useful, good qualities that will aid us in complete understanding. The second part of that letter that Ajahn Chah wrote to Ajahn Sumedho, also took it further, and he said that the Buddha Dhamma cannot be found by moving forward, by moving backwards, or by standing still. This Sumedho is your place of non-abiding. So, in a very short statement, he was pointing to that, yes, you know, all the difficult parts of the path, difficult parts of our personalities and underlying tendencies that come forward using to develop the paramitas, can then serve as the basis for the more transcendent realizations that are based on not following things, not being averse to things, not being taken in by the desires, not being trying to run away from the difficulties, not even by just freezing, not by standing still. But it's the mind's understanding, the development of wisdom that allows one to be released from all of those forms of movement of mind. And the mind can come to rest in true peace based on relinquishment. There's also a real similar kind of quote from the very first well-known verse from the Sanyutta Nikaya on where one of the devas is asking the Buddha, how is it, dear sir, that you crossed the flood? And the Buddha answers, I crossed the flood by not straining, by not holding back. That's how I crossed the flood. And then the deva asks, well, you know, expand on that. Can you tell me how it is that you crossed the flood by not straining and by not holding back? And he said, well, when I strained, I found that I got swept away. When I held back, I sank. So by not straining, by not holding back, that's how I crossed the flood. Very similar kind of teaching that points to not succumbing to either extreme, but that the middle way is the way to complete freedom from that whole flood of samsara. The rest of the fire sermon, it kind of ends with that when one realizes the burning of the habitual tendencies, the pain that it causes, and sees it very clearly as it operates through all of the six sense bases, and including the intellect base, the mind base, and how the fires of passion, hatred, delusion lead to this the suffering in our lives. And that when one sees that that truth very clearly, then one just inclines with the development of these paramitas. One just develops a disenchantment. Involvement with any of these sense bases based on the greed, hatred, and delusion. We have seen, that it's kind of a fruitless endeavor. And so the sense of disenchantment, of wanting to just say, okay, I've had enough. We need to allow ourselves to get to that place of, okay, I've done this enough. That 90% of making the same mistake over and over again until we just get tired of doing it and say, okay, I'm going to let this go and open up to a greater possibility. But we have to be willing to let it go. That's the hard part, that willingness to release, let go. But if we can do that, say, with the various aspects of the mind, then release, you know, we can be released from that intense involvement of, you know, the stories and the ideas and the opinions and the views that we have, the judgments that we make on ourselves, the judgments that we make on other people, always trying to get what it is that we want, to make the world the way we want it to be, to make the people in our lives the way we want them to be, to constantly tweak our experience so that it gets to be just right. We realize that there's no end to that. You have to ask yourself the question, am I ready? Am I ready to move on from that? Yeah. Ask yourself honestly that question. Am I ready? And then to keep working with what we have, you know, with the circumstances of our experiences, the circumstances of our lives, to bring ourselves to that state of readiness, to let go. And if we can do that, then, you know, that intense need to be involved with the objects of our experience, to fulfill the needs of greed and hatred and delusion, that starts to fade away. Consciousness won't be moving towards seeking out that object anymore. It doesn't have the desire to land and grow and proliferate in any particular area. It just doesn't have the interest. It's like one of the Buddha's teachings about that ability to let go of landing on that kind of experience. He talks about, he has a simile of consciousness of when he says, you know, suppose you're in a house with a room with four walls, and there's a window on the east side of the room, and the sun is coming in through the east window, and normally it would hit the west wall. Well, what happens to that sunlight if there's no wall for it to land on? And the monk, he's questioning, replies, well, it would land on the earth outside. And Buddha says, well, what if there's no earth for it to land on? He says, well, it would land on the water outside. Well, what if there's no water to land on? What if there's nothing for that sunlight to land on? Then, you know, the reply is, well, it wouldn't land anywhere. And the Buddha says the same with consciousness that doesn't have the fuel of greed, hatred, delusion, the underlying tendencies. When it's deprived of its fuel for landing and proliferating, growing on any of these six sense bases, and creating the world of experience as we know it based on the underlying tendencies, when it doesn't have that fuel, it doesn't land anywhere. It just doesn't find a place to alight, grow, proliferate, and get involved with. It's freed. It's not bound by that fuel. So that's the potential that we have too, just to develop that ability not to have to land, grow, proliferate based on greed, hatred, and delusion. And then with that, the mind is freed. But until we're there, and this is, you know, kind of just getting an idea of the potential, an idea of the goal, perception of it, we work with what we've got. We work with those times when the reptilian brain kind of puts out its messages and its allures and its aversions, and try and learn from them, trying to reflect on them using our our greater abilities as human beings to reflect, our motivation to find an end to suffering. So we use these impulses to learn from. And we don't try and deny that they're there or be ashamed of the different things that bubble up, because that's just what our conditioning is. But we try and react skillfully so that we don't increase, proliferate, grow with them, but see them for what they are and the suffering that it can cause if we move into those experiences. We use it as our tool for awakening, for understanding. So we transform the difficulties into strengths, and then we build on those strengths to let go of all of them altogether. And that's the way the Buddha has explained that we can reach the goal of complete peace. We use everything, as Ajahn Chah says, everything is teaching us. So I think I'll leave it there for this evening's reflection.